Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to Americans.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that.
When something profound happens like this, which I think this is pretty profound, when something profound happens like the assassination of a fucking sovereign nation's top-ranking general and maybe second or third-ranking like human being in government, like we don't even know how serious it is because so many other serious travesties occur every goddamn day that you just get lost in it, and you're like, well, is this really important, or are we just making a mountain out of a molehill?
Yeah.
Now I happen to think this is incredibly important, but it's just, I don't know, man. The numbness almost makes you want to be a conspiracy theorist. It almost makes you want to believe, you know, I'm more of an Occam's razor guy, as I've said a million times. But of course, every time I say that, I then, you know, put forward some sort of conspiracy theory. But it almost makes you think that purposely, like the powers that be, like the Orwellian 1984 government that we have, is like trying to like make us numb a bit at a time, so that when they eventually are like, well, now we've just got to kill the Jews, we'll be like, well, I guess we do. You know what I mean? I think that's how it works. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
People get beat down so much that they feel like that when something else bad happens, it's just kind of like, oh, this is just one more thing to add onto the pile, right? Oh, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot bigger perspective. Like, I think a lot of people are getting it, and they're like, whoa, this is really messed up. It's really annoying to keep hearing like the right wing media and like the basically state TV that is Fox News, like just constantly say, oh, he was a terrorist and blah blah blah, as if that like somehow excuses the fact that like we killed him. And there's like no context, like no historical context, no context of like the structure of the Iranian military and like how important the IRGC is to, you know, the country and to the military structure, you know. And there's just a lot of ignorance being thrown around, and that also really frustrates me, because when you try to talk to people about it, they just, you know, the people that are in support of it just go back to the, oh, he was a terrorist stuff. And I'm like, no. Right.
But it's a really an interesting word, that word terrorist, you know? I mean, it's such a valuable, I used to have this teacher at West Point who used to say that language, I mean, obviously he read early Chomsky, but he would say like language is the most powerful weapon in the arsenal of human affairs. And at first I remember thinking, nah, I'm pretty sure it's a hydrogen bomb, you know? but like over the years, you know, I was 19 and stupid, but now I'm like, maybe it is though, because you can't build a hydrogen bomb unless you've cowed the people through absurdist, euphemistic, powerful language for decades, if not centuries, right? Like the people should have stood up and said, no, we can't build a hydrogen bomb, because if we build it, that gives us the capacity to destroy humankind, and therefore it's in some ways a suicide pact. And of course our opponents are going to then build one. So like as soon as the government started trying to build a hydrogen bomb, the people should have been like, no. But that didn't happen, because the people had been cowed for decades and decades, really centuries, through the language of fear, right? And the language of just like aggression towards others, and the sense of defensiveness, and the sense of like both racial, ethnic, and religious difference. And I mean, I've been getting really philosophical in my old age, and I'm starting to write articles that kind of lean in that direction, because I'm increasingly persuaded that that's real. Because, like, terrorist, okay, what's terrorism? Like, okay, was Soleimani, was the Quds Force, or Quds Force, terroristic? Well, by some measures, I mean, I think there is evidence that they promoted groups that conducted terrorism, may have even conducted some of their own, maybe even some false flag stuff. But the assassination via drone of, like, another country's major leader when there's been no war declared, and also a bunch of other people in the convoy who no one gives a fuck about, right? No one gives a fuck about the other people who died. That's terrorism by definition, right? It's meant to sow terror, right, in the enemy, which the word enemy is – we can go down this road forever, right? It's like when my son asked me why, you know, and I lose my fucking mind. You know, he'll be like, Dad, were you in the Army? Yes. Why? Well, I wanted to travel and I wanted to serve my country. Why? Because, you know, I thought that there were bad guys in the world. Why are there bad guys? Well, actually, bad's a funny word. You know what I mean? And he's three and he doesn't get any of this. But, like, I'm going down a rabbit hole until at the end I'm like, just, you know, I steal this from Louis C.K. where I'm like, shut the fuck up and eat your fries, you know, like, which basically Louis does a similar bit on this. But, like, we could take the word terrorism and then, like, unpack it until we're, like, figuring out what the word is, you know? Like, it just shows how deep this goes. So, Henry, I mean, I know you started recording, so, I mean, we should probably just include what we've been talking about, right?
We can. There's no problem.
I don't even – I mean, because this is a bonus episode, I don't even know that it needs to have, like, the normal structure. I mean, this is just us talking about what happened, which, of course, listeners, is – in case anybody missed it, was the Trump administration's decision to assassinate via drone missile attack the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, Commander Major General Qasem Soleimani, and also a bunch of other guys, including, like, the assistant commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces, which is a conglomerate of Shia militias that, oh, by the way, deeply helped us, specifically the Iraqi government that we back, fight ISIS. In fact, since the Iraqi army collapsed in Mosul, that's why the PMFs, right, were formed. But nevertheless, we assassinated without a declaration of war, without congressional sanction, without even congressional notification, it seems, at least for the Gang of Eight, who you normally get notified, and we could break that down in a minute. You know, we conducted an act of war. This is tantamount to war. And so I think what we're going to do today is just break that down and take everybody's thoughts on it and then talk about why it's significant, what it portends. But I think you're right, Kagan, is the backstory that's just totally missing, because what you have is a left and a right mainstream media and political establishment that disagrees profoundly on whether this was a strategic move, right? Whether this was a good move. And they break down almost completely on partisan lines, with the exception of, like, Rand Paul, right? I mean, the Republicans completely back Trump, Democrats completely back the not Trump decision or the opposite of Trump's decision. But they all agree on one thing, which is that Iran is responsible for all this. Iran's a malign actor. And the general, right, the head of the IRGC was basically a terrorist. I mean, every Democrat feels the need to say, look, I mean, Iran's bad, and this guy was a bad dude with a lot of blood on his hands. And, like, nobody's saying, well, maybe he existed in the capacity that he did, and maybe the IRGC was formed with the charter it has based on a very, very specific and complex and defensive – I think the key word here is defensive – defensive Iranian strategy in the aftermath of the 1980-88 Iran-Iraq war. And of course it goes deeper than that, and we'll jump in. But I don't know, what do you think? Should we just go around the horn? I mean, to the extent everyone is, you know, prepared or thinking about it, and say, like, start with, like, what happened and what stood out about it, and then maybe we'll go back around and talk about some of the backstory that we think is missing. Well, you guys start, because I'll go last.
Well, I wanted to – you started off on a really cool perspective, which is, like, let's try and look at this objectively. Like, where we're not the United States and we're not, you know, these countries dealing with this stuff. Like, let's just look at this as an object, something that happened, right? So I tend to look at Iran's decisions to make these moves, like you were saying about the way the Quds Force works. We can look at that as Iran's way of doing force projection, right? Because they don't have the incredible infrastructure of, you know, our country or other countries that are able to go out and use conventional military forces. So what do they have to do? They have to use asymmetric warfare. They have to use these, you know, militias, these Shia militias that are, you know, in conjunction with their ideology. So, you know, if we were looking at it from that perspective, I think that would give people a little more context into what's actually going on, instead of just, you know, blanketing this guy with the, oh, they're terrorists and blah, blah, blah. If we looked at it from the perspective of, this is a country that doesn't have a lot of money. I mean, they're going through a really bad economic crisis thanks to our sanctions. And so they have to find a way to, like, put their message and project their strength, like any country does, right? So I just think it's really unfortunate that we don't try to look at it from that perspective.
I keep wondering how far American forces were from the actual drone site. Was it, you know, was it so close that, you know, shrapnel hit them? Because Danny, both of us have been to the Baghdad airport, you know, the green zone and such. That's supposed to be an allied area. So the idea that the Iraqis have anything left to hold them over onto our side, if they ever did, it's all gone. And oddly enough, this morning, the Iraqi parliament passed a bill asking all of our forces to get out of their country, and President Mahdi is supposed to sign it.
And this is like the third time they've done that, right?
Well, yeah, they've done it a few other times, and then we're not going to respect it, obviously, but it really says something about where we've arrived at after occupying that area for so long. And yet we're still willing to put a gun to the head in their capital, and I'm being facetious, but I think you get my point.
It is illustrative of how much matters in Iraq have gotten out of our control. You know, how much, despite the presence of our forces, despite the bullying diplomatically that we continue to do, you know, BIOP used to be an American city, BIOP being Baghdad International Airport, that's what we used to call it. Of course, you know that, you guys. But it used to be an American city, right? It was probably bigger than any city in Vermont, literally, when it was at full strength, right? Or close to it. The fact that, you know, Iran had the wherewithal to have any presence there, that the general could fly in, and that we could then strike him via a missile attack. I mean, I'm sure we still have troops at BIOP. I've not kept up with the force structure or the order of battle of American troops in Iraq for some time now, but I have to believe we have troops in and around BIOP. And so it is fascinating that, like, basically right on or right outside the airport in a convoy, we're like blowing this dude up. And it's like, wow, this is so demonstrative of, like, how out of control the whole situation has gotten. And then you say, like, well, how close are American troops? I'm wondering how close the drone operator was. Like, has it been put out? Was he in Nevada, or was he somewhere else in Iraq, or was he at another black site somewhere else? Like, I mean, I don't know if this is how it went down, but it may very well have. It would be really instructive if some 20-year-old in goddamn Las Vegas popped the second or third most powerful head of, you know, governmental person in a sovereign nation. Like, this is like war gone amok. Like, this is drone and AI warfare sort of like just gone off the rails. What, I mean, who could have foreseen this? The whole thing is insane, just from a structural point of view of like what actually happened, absent all context or all consequences.
And why didn't Bush and Obama do it? That's something I've seen numerous articles mention or infer about a little bit, that they... So I want to say Dick Cheney had wanted to, and either Bush told him no, or the people pushing back on that a little bit said, no, it's too disruptive to the region. Of course, Obama, being a little more conservative than that, probably said no right at the offset. But why was it that neither of them found any reason to do this? And like you've mentioned, Danny, we're talking about the rock star of the Iranian military, you know, someone who's not just a military officer, but a political presence in Iran, a very big presence. They were, even in their stupidity, as far as warmongers go, they both said no. And not that, I mean, Trump's like a, you know, if you give a mouse a cookie, you know, he wants to push the button and kill the terrorists and do his circle jerk with his cronies. But why did they say no and yeah. He said yes?
I think that it was a risk reward calculus. I mean, I think for all their flaws, Obama's many and Bush's uncountable flaws, I think that they, and specifically most of the people around them, or at least elements of the people around them, were able to give their advice to the presidents and say, look, this is a bad guy. This is a guy who is, in our opinion, counter to American interests in the region, dot, dot, dot. But, you know, we stand to lose more in the resultant instability of the region, B, the inevitable, because pride demands it, the inevitable retaliation against soft American targets, and then C, the increased likelihood of another war with Iran when we're already just absolutely trapped, especially back then, in quagmires in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I just think cooler heads prevailed. Like, I don't think it's because they felt any sympathy for the Iranian position or understood the context of our aggressive behavior since 1941 or definitely 53. I just think they did a risk-reward calculus and saved us the trouble. But
yeah,
what I fear is that in Trump land, you know, he has the perfect, he's like the perfect storm. Like, his unsteady temperament combined with his ignorance, combined with his laziness and his opportunism electorally, I think all of those combine to make him more malleable to the, you know, hawks within his administration to make this happen. I mean, think about it this way. You said, why didn't Bush kill him? Okay. If anyone was going to kill him, it ought to have been Bush around 2007 and 2008. Now, why? Because allegedly, and by the way, this isn't as open shut of a case as many people make it. I have no doubt that Iran played a role in backing the militias and their EFP, which were advanced IEDs, right? Their EFP, you know, bonanza that went on killing hundreds of American troops, mostly in East Baghdad and other Shia areas between 2006 and 2008 or 2009. But it's not an open shut case. I think to some extent Iranian influence has been exaggerated. But nevertheless, let's assume it wasn't. At the moment when Iran's support for the Shia militias that were killing, if not the preponderance for a while, at least a large minority of the American deaths in Iraq. I mean, one would think after 603, I think that's the count, Americans were killed by those Shia militias, specifically those bombs. Wouldn't that have been the moment to kill him? Like, why now? That's one of the things that bothers me. Why now?
Yeah.
Like, because he was maybe about to plan some attacks on a few diplomats and a few rocket attacks on some bases. And that's some pretty minor shit compared to when we were in fucking Iraq and literally had nightmares about EFPs every day and every daydream as we left the gate, wondering if we were coming home with our life or our limbs. I mean, that ought to have been the moment. And here's the other thing. We just talked about the report, right? The film, the report, all about the lies associated with the CIA torture program. Well, because I'm a masochist, I rewatched Official Secrets with Keira Knightley and also Shock and Awe with James Marsden, about the both of which were about the profound lies that got us into the Iraq War in the first place. So my question is this, like, why would we ever take the government's word for it on intelligence? Like, why would we, like, so in other words, Trump comes out and says we had to do this because he was about, he was planning and about to execute these attacks on American bases, but he provides no evidence, right? And why does he provide no evidence? Well, you know intel, right? Because, oh, it's classified, official secrets, right? Secrecy, American security. All right, that may have played in a pre-Iraq war, lie us into war invasion. I mean, it still shouldn't have, because we've been lied to since, like, you know, 1776. But theoretically, it should have. Maybe that would have applied before 2003. But in a post-2003 world, I'm like, fuck secrecy. The risk-reward there is there's more risk associated if you're lying than there is risk if you tell us something classified. So my thing for the rest of my life, and I will be such a cynic forever, I'll be like a curmudgeon, you know, in my nursing home telling all the other old people that are trying to play bocce ball that they should, you know, never trust their government. But you shouldn't. I'm like, give me the evidence. Show me. Tell me what he was doing. Publicize it. It's a, this, the public deserves to know when you commit an act of war, when you de facto place us in a state of war, when you create a fait accompli where now Iran is going to have to retaliate. Like, you owe it to the family of the people that are going to die, and mark my words, going to die in at least the singular, if not multiple, Iranian retaliations. So it's like, I don't buy the evidence. Show it to me. Publicize it. Declassify it. Because why in the world should I trust you? In a world where I've seen those three movies in the same fucking two-week period, I feel like I'm owed some evidence. No?
Definitely. Definitely. And I just, it just makes me sad. Like, I think about, like, even, like, setting aside America's perspective or the, you know, the narrative that we're being fed, let's just look at things from Iran's perspective. There's been two invasions in two countries, their direct neighbors, left and right of them, and we have built multiple bases, and we have 5th Fleet headquarters in Bahrain, which is just across the Gulf. You know, we have multiple ships there every single day. We have, like, and beyond the fact, like, we're doing these economic sanctions, which have devalued the real, like, I don't know, 75% or something. Well, it's gotten a little bit better lately, but it's still not great. It's pretty bad. And, like, we're putting this country in a position where even the people who are against, you know, what, like, say Soleimani, like, so say, like, Soleimani had a lot of support within the elite, you know, the Iranian elite and the higher-ups. But, like, there was a lot of people that weren't, like, regular Iranian people that weren't happy with what they were doing. And, well, and just with the government's doing in general. But if we attack them, like, well, if we attack them more, you know, we're only going to solidify resistance against anything that we try to do. And it just boggles my mind that, you know, I think for what you said about Obama, like, also Obama was trying to build this Iran nuclear deal. So he knew that if he killed Soleimani, like, it would be terrible and that would totally tank the deal. So he probably also thought, well, that's not going to be good strategically for him. But yeah, I don't get it. What you said, Danny, it's like, why now? Like, what, there's nothing that has been presented to us publicly about any, like, impending U.S. attack or impending, like, serious damaging thing for us to have to go after somebody this high up. And I just, I don't see how by using force, there's any like good way that we can, that like anybody can come out ahead. And Henry and I were talking about this before you got on. We were talking about how like, how we all know, you know, when situations are tense, you know, people act stupidly. And even, you know, when I was in back in like the 2010 to 2011, 12, 13, like we had so many close calls with Iran just because people got freaked out about them being close to them or, you know, ships being in the area or whatever. And people freak out and, you know, they can, people can make mistakes. So like, even now I bet things are super heightened. I bet everybody's on like the edge of their seat and pins and needles. And it just takes one person to make a stupid decision, like one officer of the watch to like mistake, you know, some missile or some radar signature for like a missile. And then, you know, they end up making the decision to shoot back. Like, we don't, you know, that kind of shit happens all the time.
But yeah, you know, you guys might have seen my article for Truthig that I pumped out at like 7 a.m. when this happened because my phone was flooded with requests. But I talked about like how many wars in history have been started by assassinations or individual insults against a singular member of someone's country, you know, like the War of Jenkins' Ear, which was like a 2-year naval war between England and Spain because allegedly like a Spanish officer had like amputated the ear of like a British merchant seaman. Like, imagine how many people died in that war over a fucking piece of ear. Like, and then like Charles Gordon dies in Khartoum in the Sudan, you know, and he wasn't even in the British army anymore. And the British go to war with Sudan and the Mahdi from like 1886 to 1898, deaths of tens of thousands, you know. And then of course World War One, right? Like the assassination of a fucking Austrian Archduke by a non-state actor.
Yeah.
Right? This is, I mean, in some ways this is worse because this is like, like they said Serbia backed the Serbian nationalists who killed Ferdinand, but
they
even
totally
if they did like, and even if they did, like, let's just like assume they totally backed him and they gave him the gun, right, and the bullets. It's like that's not even as severe and as overt as what we did, which is like one state actor bombed another state personnel. Like, it's incredible. Like, these sorts of things, like you said, now the world's on a hair trigger. And the other thing you said that's so valuable is this is the most counter, like, assume everything they say about fucking Soleimani is correct, right? Assume everything they say about Osar. He's the most bloodthirsty terrorist in the world, right? That's how they're there. He's just as bad as Baghdadi, which is, of course, fucking ludicrous. But that's what they say, right? Assume that's true. This is still the most unstrategic or astrategic move of all time. Because what was the theory? What was the theory of sanctions and maximum pressure, right? Is that what they call it or whatever that the policy is? The theory has always been, and it's been a flawed theory, that if you squeeze the regime, right, enough, if you contain them, which just means surround militarily, and if you cripple them with sanctions, which, of course, counterproductively hurts the people most, right? And we've learned throughout history that sanctions tend to actually solidify the people with their government because they resent that their starvation, because they don't blame their own government. Maybe they should, but they don't blame their own government for the sanctions. They blame the outside entity vis-a-vis the United States that's sanctioning them. But nevertheless, the theory was if you starve them and you surround them militarily, the youth, the moderates, will rise up and they will overthrow the Ayatollahs. Because most Iranians hate the regime. Now, there is some truth in the fact that the youth, in particular of Iran, is far more progressive and far more pro-Western than the youth in many other Arab countries. There's truth in that. In fact, the youth in Iran have a lot more in common with Americans than the youth in Saudi Arabia, ironically. But by doing this, by this egregious act of aggression, we have accomplished for the regime that with which they have been obsessed with doing and attempting to do since 1979, which is to solidify the entire population for all its heterogeneousness under their as loyal to them. This is what that's going to accomplish. The people, when you attack another country, I mean, look at it. Look at September 11th. Look at Pearl Harbor. When you attack another country, everyone rallies around the flag. Stupidest thing Japan could have done was attack Pearl Harbor. Why? Why? Because less than a year before Pearl Harbor, when Roosevelt wanted to put in place a peacetime draft in order to prepare for the potential of impending war, that passed Congress by one vote. Because literally half of Americans were isolationist, or at least opposed to entering the European and Pacific wars. But the minute they attacked us at Pearl Harbor, the fucking moment they attacked us at Pearl Harbor, you couldn't find an isolationist. You couldn't find a pacifist. They disappeared. They went underground, right? 99% of people rallied around the flag. So why would we want to do this? What are we – I mean, I just want to know what effect they even think this is going to have. They think because of this, now the Iranians are going to, like, what, overthrow their government? Fuck no. They're going to rally behind the government. Even if they hate that government, they're going to say, still, we'll take an Iranian government that we don't like over American foreign aggression that we don't like. And it's like the counterproductivity of American foreign policy since at least 2001 is so staggering that it makes me believe that either the most incompetent people have led our government and only incompetents are allowed to the top, which seems ridiculous. That can't be true. I mean, it can't be totally true. Maybe it can. I don't know. Or B, there's an agenda amongst a proportion of the elites, and that agenda is to drum up a war. That the agenda is to fight endless war in order to control the populace. It seems to me, I don't know, is there a third scenario? You guys tell me. It's we've been so counterproductive that it's hard not to believe that one of those two is true.
Yeah, it's one of those two.
I don't know. It's such a scary. It's just like ridiculous that, you know, and then you have Pompeo out there saying, you know, oh, this is a good thing. And, you know, and like our partners in Europe aren't being very supportive, but the partners in the region are. And, you know, they don't understand that we saved, you know, we saved lives in Europe by doing this and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, how do people like take anything that this administration says literally anymore? Like they always, they're always just promoting their own position and they're not with no explanation. Like I would be more willing to listen if they were giving an explanation as to why, other than the stupid platitudes of he was a really bad guy and needed to get taken care of. Like that's the same bullshit we've heard for the last 18 years about why we need to keep doing what we're doing. And it doesn't seem like anybody, and I know there's probably people that are working in the State Department and in the DOD and in, you know, these different levers of power that are trying to, you know, work through these scenarios, but they're the ones that aren't getting any press. Like nobody's talking to them. Nobody's asking them like, okay, what is an actual strategy for what the fallout will be? Because all we keep hearing is, this was a good thing and we need to keep, like, this was a good thing, but nobody's telling us why or what we do about it now.
And why was killing him the only option?
Exactly.
I haven't heard anyone explain why that was the best policy. In other words, I mean, call me crazy, but we have like pretty good military. I heard we have these Navy SEAL guys, and apparently we probably might have been able to intercept his convoy with overwhelming force.
He was at the fucking Baghdad airport. Like, come on. We could have easily done that.
I think we've got some guys nearby. I heard we have bases all over the Middle East. I don't know if that's still true. But, like, what if we surrounded his convoy, captured him, publicized publicly the evidence against him specifically and Iran more generally, essentially tried him in the court of public opinion, mm-hmm. and held him as leverage for Iran to call off the attacks? Possible, right? I'm not even saying that I would have done that, but it's another option that might involve, that might have at least catalyzed negotiation. Now, maybe not. Maybe they would have upped the ante on those attacks because we captured him. Maybe. I'm not even I'm not even saying that was definitely the right scenario, but isn't it more likely to catalyze negotiation and diplomacy than assassination? I mean, just in human behavior, right? Like, if you want to talk to somebody, right, even if you don't like them, like punching them in the nose or punching their best friend in the nose isn't usually the best way to get them to think rationally, is it? I mean, just from a psychological point of view, no?
I doubt the, if we did use ground forces, that he would have made it back to wherever they're camped at alive, given that, you know, it seems like lately we can't do anything but kill terrorists. We can't capture them. We can't, you know, it just, so, yeah, the SEALs or Delta is going to go and peg one on the wall again, but leave us in the same position we're in now.
Yeah, you're probably right about that, because, like, who knows if his convoy would have gone peacefully or whether they would have chosen martyrdom. But, I mean, it's just the whole thing. And then here's where I think we need to go with it, you know, because the last thing we need is for Danny to make the bonus episode like longer than an hour, but especially since we're only talking one topic. But I think we have to go to context, and we could all weigh in here. But, like, I don't know. Like, I wrote an article back in June called The View from Tehran, and I just finished an article that'll be in antiwar.com tomorrow called Who Started It? And both of those articles are about walking a mile in your adversary's shoes and understanding, like, their viewpoint. And, like, sometimes when I read as a historian, sometimes I, like, get so frustrated with how wrong America has often been that I want to, like, wave Iranian flags, just like the hippies used to wave, like, People's Republic of Vietnam flags, you know? And I wouldn't necessarily to do that in practice, but it, like, makes me want to, like, tattoo a fucking Iranian flag on my fucking bicep, because I'm so sympathetic in many ways to their cause. Now, not because I like their government. I think their human rights record is abhorrent. It's, like, right below Saudi Arabia in shittiness. But Saudi Arabia, there are shitty human rights violators, right? There are tyrants. We like them. But, I mean, just a brief walk down memory lane. Like, we overthrew their democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, in 1953 because he had the audacity to nationalize Iran's oil, which nationalize implies it was their oil, right? Would we allow fucking Russian companies to fucking do all the fracking in fucking North Dakota? I don't think so. We'd probably nationalize that shit too and tell them to go fuck themselves. But nevertheless, so we overthrow their probably first democratically elected and highly popular and mostly secular prime minister and put in charge a king. And the king, the Shah, obviously rules with an iron fist. He's got one of the most brutal intelligence services of the era. And this was an era of brutal intelligence services. You know, you had the Stasi in Eastern Europe. And in this case, you had the Savak in Persia, in Iran. So there's that. And then there's, well, the Iranians get fed up with the Shah, and thereby, through the transitive property, I took math in high school, so I remember that. Anyway, through the transitive property, they also blamed us, and so there's the hostage crisis and blah, 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 1979. But, you know, I mean, none of the hostages were, like, executed. I'm not saying they should have taken hostages, but, like, let's have some, like, perspective and scale, right? Like, okay, so, like, 52 hostages, I believe, were taken in 79, and they're held for a little over a year. None of them were murdered. I'm not saying they were treated wonderfully, but they weren't murdered. But then, like, less than a year later, Iraq, a brutal, brutal dictatorship that we thought was so brutal we had to invade it twice, we back it. We back them, and they invade Iran. Like, it's an unabashed aggressive invasion, and America supports Iraq with intelligence and satellite imagery and sales of key goods, maybe not weapons, but some of the goods needed to, you know, conduct the logistics of warfare. And we give them like $1 billion worth of aid, and 500,000 Iranians died in what for them was an existential existential war. I mean, to lose that war was to lose independence and potentially lose more than that because of the mass murderous nature of Saddam. And during that war, because we were like protecting Kuwaiti and other states that were allied to other Arab states, small Arab states that were allied to Iran, or to Iraq, you know, Iran out of desperation was trying to sink like Iraqi and then their allied oil tankers, you know, just for a war necessity. We started putting American flags on like Kuwaiti tankers. And then when Iran had dared transgress an attack, we sunk their entire Navy in Operation Praying Mantis at the end of the Iran-Iraq war. No declaration of war. We just sunk their Navy. No one ever talks about that. And then we shot down one of their airliners by mistake. Quotes, killed 290 people, and we gave a medal to the commander of that ship. And then George H.W. Bush said that he would never apologize for America. Even when America murders 290 civilians by accident, he wouldn't say, hey, sorry, guys, we didn't mean to do that. No, he refused to apologize, publicly said that. All this goes on, right? All this goes on. And this is the perspective from Tehran. And then, like you said, in 2001 and 2003, we surround them with military bases on a level never before seen in their history. On both sides, we invade and occupy their two largest neighbors to the east and the west. And then, worse still, in 2002 and 2003, we start threatening them. We start saying we're implying that after Iraq, you're next. You know, we put them in the axis of evil. There's only three countries in that motherfucker, right? In that triumvirate. And like country number one, Iraq, just got regime changed. And if you're Iran, you're like, well, the North Koreans might have nukes or almost have nukes. So they're probably not going next. I mean, the writing was on the wall. If the whole Iraq thing had went more, you know, more positively, they were next. In fact, there was that widely, widely published quote from one of the neocon insiders in the Bush administration early in the Iraq invasion, where he said, you know, everybody wants to go to Baghdad now, but real men want to go to Tehran. I mean, Iran reads, they can read. They're a literate, educated society. They read our newspapers. This shit is published around the world. From their point of view, we backed the enemy that invaded them in an existential war and killed more Iranians than had died in any war since the Persian Empire. And then we invaded both their neighbors and began to not so surreptitiously threaten them. So I guess all I'm saying is it is hard, despite Iran's legitimate flaws internationally, but more so domestically, it is hard not to want to go into the streets and take an Iranian flag to the fucking peace rally. Again, I'm not quite there yet, but it's hard not to think it. Am I crazy for that? And do we think that the media should spend a little more time on that backstory?
Absolutely. Also, you forgot one piece, which is the more recent one, of the fact that the UN or the US designated the IRGC as a terrorist organization. So thereby giving them access to use the AUMF, which is already a fucking flawed and stupid thing that should absolutely be taken care of, but legally has given them cover to create these strikes and to do more. So that's like all that history together has created the situation where we're in, where the administration can continue to say everything we're doing is legal and, you know, this is good for us. And I just, and like, or Mike Pompeo said, you can't get away with using proxy forces and think your homeland will be safe and secure. We're going to respond against the actual decision makers, the people who are causing this threat from the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm like, this is so fucked. And there has to be people somewhere in government that are willing to stand up to this and say no more. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like we have those people.
Oh, you're right. And you know what's fascinating about Pompeo's doctrine, let's call it the Pompeo doctrine, that you know, your homeland will not be safe if you use proxy forces. Well, that's a fascinating, novel doctrine, because if I was Iran, I would say, and I'm sure they will if they haven't already, I would say, great point. You, America, use more proxy forces in the greater Middle East than anyone at all. So I guess that means it's okay for us to conduct attacks on your homeland. So when we send somebody with a fucking bomb into your subway system, we're going to make the same argument. Or more more directly related, when we drop a bomb on, you know, Mark Milley while he's on a tour of the troops in Afghanistan, we're going to say, listen, you can't get away with using proxy forces. I mean, U.S. Kurdish allies, U.S. Anbar Awakening allies, you know, U.S. Afghan local police, the Saudi army, these are all proxy forces. You can make an argument, not an argument. They are proxies of the United States.
Yeah.
So if the Pompeo doctrine holds, then, you know, the logical conclusion is that it's okay to attack the American homeland. I think it's an extremely, extremely dangerous doctrine. So much so that if it had been applied during the Cold War, when the entire war was basically fought between American proxy forces in the Third World and Russian proxy forces in the Third World, the Pompeo doctrine would say that America and Russia shouldn't have nuked each other, that their homeland mm-hmm. shouldn't have been safe, right? I mean, it may sound like an absurd extension of the logic, but it's not. I mean, the guy went to West Point, which means he took four semesters of mandatory history. I don't know what his major was. Maybe he was a history major. The motherfucker ought to know better. I'm like, who was your teacher? Who the fuck taught you at fucking West Point? Makes me, like, sad for the institution. He certainly wasn't in my class. I mean, because first of all, he would have gotten an F. And second of all, if he didn't get an F, he wouldn't have fucking said something so stupid as the Pompeo Doctrine.
I mean, how many people do we know, like, American history is pretty bad already, like, as it is taught, because we, you know, we only look at things from our white, European, Eurocentric perspective. So if he got that traditional education, I don't see why he wouldn't, at least, you know, he probably wasn't thinking that way.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely not. All context is absent, you know. The Democrats and the Republicans live in different realities, which is already disturbing. And I don't think we could have the events that have been unfolding over the last 19 years. I don't think they could have unfolded quite as absurdly had not the partisan divide grown so tribal, had not, especially in the post-Trump era, or at least in the post-Fox News era, had not Americans begun to live in absolutely alternate realities with alternate facts, right? There is still such a thing as objectivity. Now, nothing is completely objective, but there's something that is approaching objectivity still exists. And mostly you find it among scholars. Scholars disagree, but there is something that we call the scholarly consensus on most issues. And sometimes the consensus is like a 99% consensus, like in climate change. Sometimes it's like a 90% consensus in most like historians' view of things like the Mexican War and things like what caused the Civil War. And then there's sometimes, you know, consensus is only 70%. But there is still such a thing as almost truth, right? That's what I'll call it, almost truth. And yet neither side even approaches it. Neither the political, like, establishment mainstream sides approaches it. Like, you've got the Republicans. We'll start with the Democrats. The Democrats are wrong about, like, 80% of this issue. The only thing they're right about is that it was stupid to do it, right? That it was stupid to assassinate this dude. They're right about that. But the other 80% of the story, context, the blame, the view from Tehran, they're wrong about all that, right? They don't even talk about it. The Republicans are almost more refreshing because they don't even pretend to live in reality. To them, it's like, no, America's always been wonderful. Iran has always been evil, and therefore we were doing God's work by murdering this guy. I mean, I almost appreciate them more because you could look at them and say, yeah, I mean, they need to be committed to an insane asylum. You know what I mean? Whereas when you look at the Democrats, you say like, ah, see, these guys are fucking, these are phonies, you know, these are frauds. You know what I mean? They're trying to sell us a bill of goods. The Republicans aren't really selling anything but crazy. I mean, they're selling crazy out of the bottle. You know what I mean? Like, they really are. I mean, it's you know, it's insane, but at least you can identify the enemy when it comes to Republicans. I'm not even like pro-Democrat. I mean, you guys have seen how many articles I've written that are criticized them, and most of my attacks come from Democrats now. Most people will attack me, but like, I mean, Republicans have gone so far off the rails and have made me so mad and have become so just demonstrably evil to the effect that evil exists that they could run Jesus Christ. They could run Jesus of Nazareth for president in 2020 and I'd vote for Joe Biden. Okay. Like, not, and I'm not saying I'm going to vote for Joe Biden, but like, you know what I mean? Like, if I had to vote between the two, I'd be like, well, this guy who heals the sick seems pretty cool, but he's got that R next to his name. And I remember George Bush, you know what I mean? Like, there's no way. And I think that's, I guess what I'm saying is that I'm part of the problem, but I almost blame them for making me part of the problem. And, as much as that's a cop out, and the context that I talked about, the context that you guys talked about, turn CNN on right now. I mean, this story still dominates the news. At least it did all last night when I couldn't sleep. And for my sins, I was watching CNN. But, you know.
Well, the fact that you're even like that, you even have to put yourself in that box. That's what pisses me off. Like, everything is an either or thing. And as you said, there's no room for nuance, for context, for like objectivity. It's just, you know, what side of the issue are you on? Like, we've boiled everything down political into those two categories, and it's a false dichotomy, and it really pisses me off because like nobody is asking those questions outside of that box, or if they are, they're not getting, you know, the attention, they're not getting the press that needs to be, you know, you need in order to really understand these complex geopolitical issues that come from so much history. And it's hard to talk to my family about it, you know, and some of them have no clue about the context, and they just want to say this guy is bad and this person's bad and we're good, you know. And it lacks critical thinking, it lacks awareness, it lacks all those things that we should be promoting in you know, a democracy. If we need a functioning democracy, we need people to think critically. And I don't see that being really pushed in any of the mainstream narratives at all.
You're absolutely right about the binary. When the decision to go to war, and when the facts that precipitate said war, which is the most extreme human behavior, right? The bloodiest, most extreme human behavior besides destroying the planet through climate change. War is the most extreme human behavior. When war itself and the facts surrounding the run-up to war become so politicized that the two sides totally go against one another, regardless of those facts, because they have their own facts, then a nation is inevitably and logically on the road to forever war. I mean, there used to be, and it was always a bit of a misnomer, it was always a bit of a myth, but there was some truth to it. During the Cold War, there was this phrase, you guys have probably heard it, a popular phrase among historians and political scientists, where they would say, partisanship stops at the ocean's edge. Meaning that Republicans and Democrats would always and forever disagree about health care, but when it came to the Soviet threat or the German threat, there was some willingness to like have a collegial debate and work together for the best interests of the United States. Well, those days are over. Mm-hmm. Over. Look at the vote on Syria, right? Not a single Democrat flipped. Look at the vote on Yemen. What? 10 Republicans flipped. You know, look at the every single congressman and every single senator has been forced to give a statement on their website or on the TV networks. And how many Democrats have supported Trump? I think the answer is zero, at least full out. And how many Republicans have supported, you know, that Trump was, you know, were against Trump? I mean, Rand Paul and maybe a couple others. I mean, it's
except
become
when it comes to the defense budget, basically.
Right, and then on the defense budget is, yeah, it's the only bipartisan thing, right? I mean, unless you're Bernie Sanders, like, everyone's voting for it. But, you know, this is scary, scary stuff. You know, I think we've beat this up a little bit, and I have a feeling on our next episode we're going to have to, like, readdress this in a shorter segment because, tell me if I'm way off base, but let's say we record later this week or early next week. It is very likely, not definite because they may be patient, but it is very likely that we're going to have to discuss Iran's initial retaliation because it may already have happened. In fact, it may already have happened. Probably not, but it may have already happened by the time this episode is released, by the time our listeners are listening. So I think we're going to have to readdress this. But the last point that I want to make is this. It's a constitutional point. People seem to have forgotten about the constitutional structure surrounding war making. Well, what Trump did with this action is he made war, well, first of all, he committed an act of war, but secondarily, but more importantly, I think, he made war inevitable, right? Now, what he did was he created a war, and then he, at best, right, left Congress, the media, and the people to pick up the pieces and decide whether to support their country now that their country's at war, which puts those people in a very difficult position because to not support the war that Trump just started is to seem unpatriotic and against the troops, right? Let me give you an example of when this happened before and why the Constitution, as far as the Constitution says, this is not how it's supposed to work, right? There's supposed to be deliberation in the legislative body as to whether war is necessary, right? Unless it's directly in self-defense, in which case the president has like 90 days, you know, before Congress has to sanction it, you know, War Powers Act and all that. But I have a problem with the War Powers Act. Doesn't get me started on that. We'll do that in another episode. But legalistically, here's something that happened in the past. In 1836, I promise I'll try to be brief. In 1836, Texas slaveholders, who were illegal immigrants, most of them in Mexico, decided to rebel against Mexico's sovereignty over the province of Texas because Mexico had outlawed slavery and Mexican law said, and they had agreed to it when they first came, that they had to convert to Catholicism. That was the rules. That was their sovereign nation's rules. They have every right to do that, right? Well, the Texans, who were really just Americans from the South who decided to get free land in Texas or cheap land in Texas, they wanted to be slaveholders because they were monsters, and they wanted to stay Protestant because they wanted to stay Protestant, and they thought that Catholic Mexicans were like subhuman. So they had a rebellion, and they broke off and formed their own republic. Now, according to international law at the time, even the British said, this was still part of Mexico. Mexico abrogated the treaty that Santa Anna had been forced to sign on pain of death. Okay, so he had been forced. They annulled that, and they continued to say that Texas was theirs, and there was even some fighting along the border. Well, Southerners and some Westerners in the United States had always wanted to annex Texas, and Texas wanted to be annexed. But for 9 years, it wasn't done. Because similar to the reason that Soleimani wasn't assassinated earlier, the cooler heads in Washington realized that the annexation of Texas was tantamount to war with Mexico, right? Because according to international law and according to Mexican policy, Texas was still theirs. James K. Polk gets elected as a dark horse, probably America's like biggest dark horse candidate up to that point. No one had ever heard of him, but he became like a big populist. And he ran on two platforms. One, I'm going to take the Oregon country from the British, but he meant that through negotiation, not war. And two, I'm going to annex Texas. Okay. Gets elected. He supports the annexation of Texas. Tantamount to war, right? Then, using his commander-in-chief Article II authority, he sends an army, small army, about 5,000 guys, but our army was so small that that was a big portion of it, under Zachary Taylor, who later became a president, into Texas. Okay, that was another act that was tantamount to war. But then even further, he sends them across the Nueces River to the Rio Grande. Now, the entire international community agreed with Mexico that the Nueces River was the boundary, because when Texas was a province of Mexico, the Nueces River, which is just north of the Rio Grande, was the boundary. So therefore, when Texas secedes, right, if even if that was legal, when Texas secedes, the Nueces would remain the boundary, right? But the Texan rebels were like, ah, we kind of want that land between the Nueces and the Rio Grande. And so they really wanted what became Corpus Christi, blah, 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 blah. So Polk not only annexes Texas, tantamount to war, he sends an army over the internationally recognized boundary, unilaterally says the Rio Grande is the boundary, knowing full well, we now know from all the declassified documents, knowing full well that this would start a war because he wanted a war. Now, this is not how the Constitution was set to work. Now, we know what happened. Mexican lancers, out of pride and out of sovereignty and nationalism, attacked and killed some of our cavalrymen, which then gave Polk the catalyst he needed, the justification he needed, to go to Congress and ask for a declaration of war. Now, think about the fait accompli he accomplished. Think about the quandary he put the Congress in. Because he says to them, war has already begun. Will you not support your nation? Will you not give me a declaration of war? And of course, by a large bipartisan majority, even though a lot of the Whigs were skeptical, they were fearful that it would look like they weren't supporting their country or their troops. They were fearful they would lose their seats. And so almost all of them, except for the indefatigable 15, led by John Quincy Adams, except for them, everyone voted for the war. Now, the reason I tell this story is I would argue Trump has done something quite similar. The only difference is Trump won't even have the good measure and the prudence to go to Congress and ask for a declaration of war now. He won't even do that because we're so fucking far through the looking glass. We're so constitutionally off the rails, he won't even do that. But if he did, he'd be putting – even if he did, I bet you most – almost certainly that we would accede to an AUMF, because he has created a situation where we're already at war. But we all know, all three of us, and I think most of our listeners know, that this is not how the Constitution was designed regarding war making. Mm-hmm. One of the flaws of the Constitution, though, is that it does have that loophole where it says the president is commander-in-chief of the army, which allows a cynical – right, president like James K. Polk or Donald Trump to do things like this or crossing the Nueces River that make war all but inevitable. And so my last point today is, like, let's all pause and consider the constitutional ramifications for Trump's actions, how they build on Polk's actions, how they actually exaggerate and take a step further down the road to perdition, Polk's actions, and what this, and I'm going to leave this as a rhetorical question, what this means constitutionally, legalistically, for America and its presidents going forward. And all I'll say is count me concerned about what this portends, if that makes sense.
We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill, and also at Facebook.com at Fortress on a Hill. You can find our main blog page and our full collection of episodes at www.fortressonahill.com. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify, you name it, almost anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. And hey, we're always in the market for more Patreon supporters. Please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com. And if you're not into giving us a monthly payment, think about giving us a couple bucks on PayPal. The link is in the show notes. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
And listen to my song. I hope you'll pay attention. I will not detain you long.